Okay, good afternoon. Okay, so last time we talked about a bunch of things related to how we go from something like C into what we actually load into memory. So we talked about like what the layout of a program in memory was. So we had these fixed by convention locations where we put particular parts of a program. And to get things there, we had this multi-step compilation to an assembling and linking process, where first we took our C code, turned it into assembly, which you were familiar with from 2150. Then we took that assembly and turned it into this thing called an object file, where we have most of the machine code, but we have some placeholders for thing addresses because we haven't decided yet where things are actually going to be. And in linking is where we make those decisions about where do I want to put this code in memory now? Where do I want to put this string in memory right now? And from that topic, we also talked about pointer arithmetic, which is basically just treating pointers like numbers. And I explained that this is how arrays in C really work. So any questions on any of these topics before we move on a little bit today? Okay, we'll see if any later. So first, some other things. So I mentioned there's anonymous feedback on Colab. I read it. I'll occasionally show some. I'm not going to be like some other faculty here and show like absolutely everything that comes through anonymous feedback, no matter how weird it is. So one thing is someone said, paraphrasing, that they like learning from videos. Are there good videos on the topics in this course? So the best place to look for that sort of thing, presuming that you don't find my lecture videos supplementary, which is perfectly fine, would be other computer architecture courses. So CMU and Georgia Tech both have some videos online, for example, but they don't cover quite the same topics, and they often use a different instruction set, which is a big problem when you find anyone else's materials on computer architecture that all of a sudden you need to learn MIPS or something else, even though it's the same underlying concepts. But maybe that would be useful to you. For this part of the course, there's not so much because we're kind of in a strange place filling in holes from 2150, and typically other institutions cover things in a different order. But for particular topics, there probably are good explanations for topics we'll get to later in the semester if you want some alternate, want someone teaching it who's not me and explains it differently. So, anonymous feedback saying that the content was presented pretty ambiguously. So a general comment on this, I believe you. I believe I did tons of things wrong last week in lecture, on the quiz, you know, everywhere. And I have guesses as to what those are, but when I get a comment like this, I'm relying on my guesses. And most of the time, what you think was bad is not what I think was bad. And if you want me to fix things that you thought were bad, you need to tell me what those are. Otherwise, I'm just guessing, and you telling me they're bad is not actually going to have me fix the problems you want fixed. So just to mention that, like, I appreciate that you didn't like what happened. And if you just wanted to vent, that's fine. But if you actually wanted to help me, I need more specifics. Otherwise, I'll fix what I think was broken, which might be the wrong thing. And a question that, can quizzes be due on Tuesday? So I'll try to explain the intent behind when quizzes are due. So when we have reading quizzes, which will probably be not next week, but the week following, so everyone has time to get a textbook, and hopefully the bookstore will have textbooks. The quiz on lecture and lab material will be Thursday through Saturday, and then following that will be a quiz on reading. And the hope here is that you can see how you did on the lecture quiz before you do the reading quiz, so you know if you need to like study up on something from the previous week. That's the intention behind it. That's why it's Saturday and not Tuesday. It's not because I want you to work hard over the weekend.
For next week's reading quiz, is that going to cover the chapters from last week and this week they were supposed to read, or just this week?
So the first reading quiz, which will probably be not next week, but the following week, will cover just that week. My assumption is that anything I care about, I will have covered in the post-quiz previously for the previous chapters. And yes, since I'm not doing pre-quizzes, I could adjust them, but I want to make sure you're in the right habit, because I know if I changed when the quizzes were due suddenly, I'd get lots of emails saying, I didn't take the quiz. And I don't want that to happen. Yes?
So the reading quizzes are on the reading that was supposed to be done the week before, not the week that we're going to
do? The reading quizzes will be on the reading that is supposed to be for the week of the quiz. The expectation is you read before lecture, as you should be doing in all your courses, even though I'm sure pretty much none of you do that. Okay, any other questions on this? Okay, so speaking of the quiz, let's move on and talk about the quiz from last week, since a lot of people had trouble with that. So one question was true or false about object files. In addition to the machine code itself, the object file contains information about where in the machine code memory addresses will be when the program runs. And when I wrote this, I was trying to get at those placeholders, what we call relocations, that they say to the linker, put a memory address here. And to say that, we need to say, where does the linker need to put a memory address? And so that's how that information is in the object file. So it says where the memory addresses will eventually be in the machine code, wherever that machine code ends up in memory. And another question that I think was the most wrongly answered thing on the quiz was the object file, not this one, sorry, the other thing related to this. Most people got also the names of labels in the assembly file. So if you remember on our slide, this was the symbol table. We need to know if I had main, something calls main. If I have puts, something calls puts. I need to know where it is in the object file when I'm doing linking. And that was the symbol table writing it down. Also, when we had those placeholders, we needed to know what they were for. And if we had call puts, we were actually going to refer to puts by name. So we need to have the name puts in order to link the program that we had in this example because it called puts. That makes sense on this? Okay, and finally, the tricky one I thought was next, which is the object file contains information about where each instruction starts in the machine code. So in retrospect, I should have like bold italiced each in the quiz, because that's the key word here. So we know about where some instructions are. So if you have a label, if you say this is where main starts, the object file says, this is where main's first instruction is. But we don't actually know about each thing in the machine code because the linker doesn't care. The linker is just going to copy that whole bunch of machine code into memory, and it doesn't need to know about what happens inside it. So there's no reason to record that information, so it's not there in the object file. Now, if you understand how the machine code works, yes, you can look at the machine code and say, this is what this instruction looks like, and find the beginning and end of each. But there's not a reason to record that information otherwise. That makes sense? Questions? Yeah. So also, a bunch of people got the endianness question wrong. And this is a confusion about what followed by means. I probably should have said in memory to make it clearer, because when we talk about arrays, we never say that something follows something else in memory if we go from a high to a low address. So we told you that's not how arrays in C work. It's not how any sort of arrays in anything you know works. But that was the idea, is that when I say followed by, of course, we go from index 1 to index 2, not index 2 to index 1. And that's our definition of endianness, is that lowest index is least significant, which means at the end of a number, the way we write it in English. So that's what little endian would mean. Okay. And a final comment. So I glanced over the comments to the quiz. I have a TA who will actually read through them carefully. In comments, please do not refer to answer letters because they're randomized. So when we read the comments, we can't really figure out which answer B was for you. So if you're writing a comment, say something like quote the answer, copy and paste it, or something like that, so we know what you're referring to without answer letters. So any other questions on the quiz? Anything about the quiz from last week? I'm good. So on a final piece of logistics, there is lab this week, Wednesday. You can go to the lab and do it. It should be perfectly doable in 75 minutes in the lab, and there will be TAs to help you there. If you want to do it on your own, I'm not going to stop you. You will download a 64-bit Linux executable and use a debugger or some other tools to figure out what input it expects. So the tools that we have on our lab machines output AT&T syntax assembly by default, which is not what you're used to. We will talk probably later this week about what AT&T syntax assembly looks like compared to what you're used to. But for now, the lab write-up tells you how to make all those tools switch to Intel syntax so you can have what you saw in 2150. In theory, everything in this lab, all this assembly, is just 2150 stuff. But in practice, you might notice on the schedule we're reviewing assembly, so you can guess what I actually think about whether it's really 2150 stuff. Any questions on the lab? Okay, so everyone's set for Wednesday. And you need to have the part we want you to do in lab, which is phase one. It will be obvious what that means when you get it. Done by the end of day Wednesday. And for homework is to do phases 2 and 3 by next Wednesday at noon, a week from tomorrow. So with that out of the way, let's move on to the topic we were talking about last time of arrays in C. And I mentioned this simple rule about how arrays in C work. Arrays are just adding things to pointers. So our array index syntax is exactly doing pointer arithmetic by taking our array, treating it as a pointer, and adding something to that pointer. And this works because our arrays turn into pointers when we try to treat them like a pointer. And I showed you an example which used array of chars, which are 1 byte. So adding 1 to a pointer to a byte gives you a pointer to the next byte. But that doesn't work for things which aren't a single byte, like an int. An int on our lab machines is 4 bytes. If you add 1 to that, you get something which overlaps and doesn't quite match up. And what C has done is they've decided that they're going to make the same concept work regardless of whether the thing you're pointing to is a byte or not. So all the things we showed you with arrays of characters, you can do with arrays of integers and pointers to ints. And the way it works is when we do something like add 2 to a pointer to int, instead of adding 2 bytes, it adds 2 ints because it's a pointer to an int. So that means when we produce the assembly for this, it's going to add 8 to the actual pointer. And the compiler is going to figure out that multiplication for you. Yes?
Do you mind showing us visually what you mean?
So the question is, can I show you visually what I mean? I can try. So here we have an array of ints. So these are 4 bytes each. And if I have a pointer to here, and let's say this is address 10, if I in C write pointer plus 1, if I was just taking the address and adding 1 to it, I'd get a pointer to this in the middle of the integer. And so the thing that I would be pointing to would be something like this box. So C doesn't do that. Instead, C says, when you add one to the pointer, you get here. This is pointer plus one, which is going to be address 14. And it does that because you told it when you declared the pointer that it's an int star. So it knows how big it is because it knows what the size of an int is.
So it just automatically goes to the next number instead of taking like an invalid?
Yes, so it automatically goes to the next int in memory when you add one, and it skips ahead by two if you add two, and so on. And one way of remembering this is that this equivalency here of for array indexing to pointer arithmetic just always works no matter what types are involved. So another way of looking at it is whenever you see something which looks like arithmetic with a pointer, you can just pretend you have an array and turn it into array indexing. Any questions about this? Okay. So from what we've seen so far, arrays look just like pointers. Since array indexing works on pointers because it just turns into pointer arithmetic, and pointer arithmetic we define as doing things to the addresses of pointers, it seems like arrays and pointers are pretty much exactly the same thing. And I had a question on the quiz where every time arrays and pointers did exactly the same thing. So you might think that they're interchangeable in C. And this is almost true, but not quite. Yeah?
What if, like, say you had some kind of dynamically allocated array where you weren't sure what, like, data type it would store? So at runtime, would that addition, like, know how many bytes to show?
Okay, so the question is, so I know about dynamically allocated arrays, and you might not know the type of the thing in the array until runtime. So is the compiler going to figure out for me how to get to the next element because of what I allocated? And to answer this, we have to look at how is the compiler determining that it needs to go ahead 8. And the way it's doing that is solely by looking at this. So unless you can somehow change how you declared the pointer, you can't change what the compiler will do for the arithmetic. So you would need to handle it manually for your situation of having an array of variably sized things. So as I was saying, it looks like arrays and pointers basically are the same thing in C, but it's not quite true. And this might get you sometimes. So one thing is that we showed you that you can take an array and treat it like a pointer. In particular, you can assign a pointer to an array, and this is the same thing as getting a pointer to the first element of the array. If you try to do the opposite, that's an error. It won't compile. So you can't change where arrays are after you've declared them. So another difference is in the size of operator. So who here has used the size of operator before? So most of you. So the size of operator, it's an operator, not a function, even though it looks like a function. It returns the number of bytes in whatever you pass to it. And for arrays, arrays have the size that includes all of their elements. Pointers are the size of that address. So in our live machines, addresses are 8 bytes, so the size of every pointer is 8 bytes, because that's the size of the thing in the pointer, which is just a memory address. So this is a way, big difference. So how about this? So what's the size of what I told you arrays turn into? So I told you these rules about size of is the size of the thing, and if it's a pointer, the size of a memory address. So what's the size of that? Yeah. 8. So 8, which is the size of a pointer, because what that syntax says is get the first element of the array and make a pointer to it. So it's giving us the size of the pointer. And in the same way, when we have a normal pointer, it's forgotten about the array. It only knows about the pointer, and it gives us the size of a memory address. Any questions about this? Okay, so arrays are almost like pointers, but not when you're asking about sizes, and not when you're trying to assign things. So a note on precedence. So you notice that I used ampersand before an array element to take a pointer to that array element. So we have the precedence where we do the array indexing and then take a pointer to it. And that's the precedence in C and C++. The dereferencing operator works the same way. And this is not what many people expect when they start dealing with pointers to pointers, which is why I'm mentioning it. And also we have something similar happen, well, something similarly unexpected, but it's probably not actually quite analogous, for the post-increment operator. My advice is not to use the post-increment operator with pointers because it's probably confusing, but if you see it, it increments the pointer, not the pointed to value, when you use it like this, unless you add parentheses. Any questions about these? Yeah.
So you said on the last one, the star plus plus will actually increment the pointer, not the value of the size?
Yes. And so it's this. So the question is, star foo plus plus increments the pointer, not the value inside? Yeah. And this is because we do the star foo plus plus first. The foo plus plus first, and then do the star. Yeah.
So when you use the post-increment operator like that, does it also follow the rule of like incrementing by the correct number of bytes?
So the question is, does the post-increment operator also follow the rule of incrementing by the correct number of bytes? Yes. So otherwise, it acts like foo plus equals 1. As far as what it actually does. And that one is scale based on what foo points are, according to the declaration you gave in your code. Yeah?
What actually happens if you try to increment a pointer? Is it just simple?
So the question is, what happens if you try to increment a pointer? It's the same as foo plus equals 1 or something like that, which we've seen in our exercises before. So as long as it still points to part of an array, you're fine. And you can absolutely do it, and you will commonly, in real C code, see people do that. I give these examples because these are all things which will come up in C code you are likely to see at some point in the future. Any other questions about this? So now to switch to a non-C topic, which is about the command line. And this is mainly because there are things you're going to do in the command line, and we'd like you to have more of an idea of how to use the command line effectively. So one thing I'd like to talk about is that there are manuals. So commonly what you do when you don't know how to use Linux is you Google to figure out how to do it and find the first thing. I don't mind you doing that, but we actually have documentation built into all the lab machines. And this is via a command called man for manual. So if I want to find out how to use the man command, I can use itself to look up that information by running man for manual for man. And if I do that, I get this manual page. And if you're just reading a manual page like this for the first time, it's pretty big, has lots of stuff in it. Maybe not something you're, you know, want to read all the way through. If you want to look for something quick, one thing you can do is look for an example section. And if we go down here, there's examples. So it says, for example, manls displays the manual for ls. There's a -a option. If there's multiple things with the same name, we can look up all the manuals with that name. We can print things out. We can do a keyword search. So it gives the example of man-k printf, which is searches the descriptions for printf and shows you all those manual pages. So for to just run that example, if you run man-k printf, we get a list of all the things that are like printf. And there's one command I'd like to mention in particular, besides man, but which is chmod. So let's look up the manual page for chmod. Chmod is change file mode bits, which is pretty meaningless. But what it does is it controls who can access files. So it lets you set files to be readable by others or not. And there, unfortunately, are no examples in this man page. So I happen to have one on a slide. So this is a command you may or may not want to run on the lab machines. It says, recursively, change the permissions of the files in my home directory with whatever OG minus R means. And we could carefully look through the manual page to figure that out. But I'll give you the brief description rather than having us scroll through that. So the O and G stands for others and the group you're in. So on the lab machines, everyone is in the group student. The minus sign says remove some permissions. So make these people have less access to all these files. And the R stands for read. And one thing about our lab machines is that this actually does something. By default, home directories are world readable. Yeah. So the question is, what does the recursive do? The recursive says, don't just change my home directory, but change all the files and directories inside it. So the question is this the actual command as is? Yes, except that you replace user with the name of an actual user or an actual directory. And there are other permissions you can adjust. So I showed you O and G for others in group. There's also user for yourself, your user. And you can remove or add permissions. And the three major permissions that are supported are read, write, and execute. So these might sometimes come up when you transfer files. In particular, if you transfer an executable wrong, it might not be marked as executable. This command will let you do that. You can say chmod u plus x, the like bomb you just transferred and wasn't executable, and make it so you can execute it if you get a permission denied when you try to execute it. And if you somehow transfer a file so it's not readable or writable by you, you can fix it this way. And if you want like more detailed information, the manual page is sort of the definitive source. You can also just Google it, but you know that varies in quality. The manual page might not be the most tutorial-like, but at least it's consistently accurate and about the machine you're actually using and all that. So besides chmod, another command we'll use a lot is tar. So tar is the standard file archive utility. So it makes archives of files And sometimes we need to distribute you a lab with a whole bunch of files. So we'll give you a tar file and expect you to transfer it to the lab machine and extract it. And you don't need to like log in and double click on it to do that. You can do this via the command line. And tar has a really weird historical syntax. So here's the basic tar commands, which should count for everything you'll need in this course. There's a whole bunch more. You can look up the man page by typing man tar if you want all the details. So TF, T for table of contents, and F for file. And then the name of a tar file will show you all the files inside it without extracting it, without messing up your home directory or wherever you're typing the command. If you want to extract it, you use the X letter. And I have XVF. The V is for verbose, which means it will show you what files it's creating. Otherwise, it will still work. It just won't tell you what it's doing. And it will look like nothing happened until you type LS. And you can also create one with C instead of X by specifying what you want to put inside it. And because this is very old, you have to specify the F. That doesn't make much sense. Isn't there always a file? Well, historically, this utility was designed for tape drives. So if you don't specify F, it assumes you want to use the tape drive that isn't connected to our lab machines. Any questions about this? Yeah.
Can you tell it where to extract to?
Yes, there is an option to do that. I believe it's to, you say to change directory. I would have to look it up in the man page because I don't have it memorized. Most typically, I just move the tar file to where I want it extracted, but you shouldn't have to do that. And another thing about command lines I'd like to mention is tab completion. So you don't have to type out file names completely. So for example, let's say I want to get to my folder of CS3330 stuff. I could type out cd fall2017/CS3330, you know, slides, for example. Or I can use tab completion. So I type cd space sl, fa, the start of the directory I want, and just press tab, and it completes it for me. And then I can type the start of what I want, say cs, and, well, it doesn't. So what happened? I have another directory in there with a different name, and I say, oh. I press tab again, and it shows me, oh, there's two options, and it shows me what they are, so I don't need to say, oh, I don't remember exactly what this is called, and stop typing that command and type ls and so on. I can just press tab again, see what the options are, and then write enough of it so I can actually complete it without actually having to type out the whole thing. So I press tab now, and it completes it. I can keep doing this for all the directories inside I want. So I know I want a folder starting with lowercase s, oh, I want slides, and so on. And this just works for me going around in the command line. And I'm mentioning this because we often see people frantically typing out long file names, making a little typo, and we don't want you to waste that time. So, should save your time to know about this if you don't already. Another thing that exists is history. So, if I want to run a similar command to what I did before, I can press the up arrow or down arrow to look at my previous commands. And then I can use normal things to edit it. So, let's say I did mistype chmod. I don't need to retype the whole thing. I can press up arrow, recall what I just typed, and use the arrow keys to edit that command rather than retyping the whole thing to fix my typo. And actually get it to do what I want. So just letting you know, because that should make you more efficient. We're not going to test you on it or anything like that, but I just want you to waste less time in lab fighting with Unix. Any questions on any of this? Okay, so with that interlude, now let's go back to C. So I talked about sort of language level features of C that you didn't see in C++, mostly because you used something like vectors in C++. Next, I'm going to talk a bit about the libraries in C. And this is probably the most noticeable difference when you see C code versus C++, and that C doesn't have IOStream. There's no C out, there's no C in. Instead, we have a different library, which is in standard.io.h. And you might say, well, how do I find out what the things in standard.io are? And one thing you could do is you look for it on your favorite search engine. You could look in our textbook. But there's another option, which is that these manual pages. So in addition to man having information about commands, it also has information about C functions. So if I type man standard.io, the name of the header file I know all these functions are in that replace IOStreams in C++, I actually get a manual page which describes them. And this is the authoritative documentation. Maybe not the easiest to read, but it's definitely right for the machine and should be pretty complete. So it says, oh, there's something called standard in, standard out, and standard error in there. And if I look further down in this description, it gives a list of functions. So there's just an index of every single function in standard.io. So you can look through this and say, where can I find the thing I want to do? So you have the only thing you know is it's somewhere, there's some standard IO function. This is where you can start looking. So and the most important to you probably function in standard IO is going to be printf. And here's an example of how printf works. So printf is basically the closest equivalent of cout. But it works pretty differently. So in cout, you put the variable or expression you want to print out in the middle of the line. You have little chunks of strings that you mix in with your integers or strings that you want to print out. In printf, you have this template where you have these sort of placeholders marked with a percent sign. And what's after the percent sign says what type of argument you're passing to printf. So this percent %d says I'm expecting a number that I want to print out as decimal as the first argument. And the percent %s says as the next argument, I'm expecting a string I want to print out as is. And this is basically the same as passing custno after the constant string with the customer number, and so on, as you do in C++. Yeah?
If you kind of say like something, like a number and then a percent, will it error if you use the percent sign after as a string?
So the question is, let's say I want to put a literal percent sign in my template. Is that right? Yeah. How do I do that? Well, you can't use just a single percent. You need to do something else. It turns out what you'll need to do is to use two percent signs to represent one. So something that's notably different from C++ is that the format string, which is what this template is going to be called when you read the documentation, has to match the types of the arguments. So I specified that I want a, here, that this is percent %d for an integer. I needed to pass an int. I couldn't have passed a string. And if you do so, bad things will happen. Like, not an error, probably, but like crashes. And similarly, I specified I want a string for the second placeholder. If I passed an int, bad things would happen. basically, what typically, but not always happens, is that the compiler will just interpret whatever you pass as that type. So if I passed an int, we're expected a pointer to a char, it would convert the integer into a pointer and try to look for a string wherever that's specified in memory, which would usually crash. Yeah? So the question is, what if I specify 2% D's, what does it expect? It always looks for the things in the format string to appear in the same order in the arguments. So if you specify another percent D, the corresponding argument would need to specify another number. It doesn't look at the types at all, it just looks at what the place is. So this example I showed you, you can use a percent %d to say I'm going to pass you an int. As the next argument, you can use a percent %s to say I'm going to pass you a string, meaning a pointer to a char as the next argument. And there are a whole bunch of other options. This is an incomplete list. And they expect particular types. And you can, and they output things in different ways. So there are multiple ways of passing an int, which print out the integer as hexadecimal or as decimal, depending on what you put in the format string. And you can refer to this table later when you need it. If you want more detailed and more complete documentation, there's a man page. And the command you use to get at that is man3printf. You might ask, what's the 3 from? So, let's demonstrate why I said to use a 3. If I type man printf, I get this. This looks like it's documentation about printf, and it is. It's about a command called printf, not a C function. So if you remember from earlier, we can use the dash A option to say, show me all the things called printf, in which case we will first get the command called printf. And then next it will say, oh, next I have something called printf with the 3 after it, meaning it's in what is called section 3, which is conventionally actually where the printf we care about is, not that you have any way of knowing that. And if I look at that, that looks like a C function now. So if you look in here, you'll find the incredibly detailed documentation about all the options to printf. Like this is D I mentioned earlier is here. It's many pages, but if you ever need to find out any particular weird thing to do with printf, it's in there. Most likely, you're going to be quite happy with this table, because we're not going to have you exactly format any outputs in this course. Any questions on any of these format strings or how printf works? So that's my foray into getting you to know just enough about how to look things up about the standard library and use printf, which is the most important function for debugging, probably. So you can write C, which is about all we use the standard library and OS facilities in this course. We're not going to be parsing files or anything like that. And so I have a few more miscellaneous C topics, which are also things in C++ that you just didn't see in 2150 because they never came up. So one of them is GoTo. So GoTo is a thing that exists in C and C++. I don't recommend using it, but I'm telling you it exists, and it does a very straightforward thing. So it just jumps to the location. So you can think of GoTo as translating exactly to an assembly jump. And the label that you go to, which is, you can do that in C, even though you've never had a reason to, translating exactly to a label in assembly. It works exactly the same way. I'm just mentioning this because you probably never saw it in C, and lots of people will probably not tell you to do it. At least in this example, you can kind of justify doing this. And I show this example of having a doubly nested loop using GoTo to get out of it, because it's hard to do it another way, so you might see that in real C code. And we might use GoTo in this course in order to translate assembly code to C without losing much, even though it's probably not how you should write C. So any questions about this? Okay. So a final C thing I want to go over is about structs. And this is another thing which is different from C++. So in C++, declaring a struct is basically the same. But after you do this, you'd expect to just say rational 2.5. But here, I'm saying struct space rational 2.5 to declare an instance of that struct. And the word struct is not optional in C. In C++, it would be. In C, it is mandatory. There is nothing called rational. It's called struct rational. That's just how it works. Yeah?
What exactly is rational?
So
is that just like a function?
So rational is the, so the question is, what is rational then, if I can't use the name rational? Is it just a function name? So it's a struct name. It's just in C, struct names don't automatically become type names. You have to use the word struct to say, this is some type of struct. So they aren't automatically something like an int, like int. Like you can use int to declare a variable. You can't do that with something you've said as a type of struct. You have to say struct and the type of struct to do it. You still seem confused, so hopefully.
I think she's confused on like what a struct is.
What a struct is? Have you seen?
We used it once in 2015.
So. I thought you used it more. Okay, so I need to explain what structs are. So structs are classes without methods. Is probably the easiest explanation from what you should know in 2150. I thought it was covered in 2150, I'm sorry. Covered in reasonable detail in 2150. They're basically just classes without methods. Wow. So they have instance variables, and that's it. And you just access the instance variables directly, like you see here. Yes. So is there some way that I can avoid typing struct every time? Because dealing with a rational number by typing struct rational all the time seems very annoying. And the answer is yes, and it's my next slide. So there's something in C and C++ called typedef. And this defines a new name for a type. So instead of typing struct rational all the time, I could define a struct with some name I don't really care about, and then say, I would like to make another name for that type, that class without methods. And I would like that name to be rational. And after I do that, I can use the word rational as a type, just like I'd use int as a type, and refer to the struct that way. And you will commonly see this in C code. Yes?
Could you keep the struct name rational as well? You say typedef struct rational rational?
So the question is, can I, instead of having other name for rational, could I do rational? And the answer is, okay, but maybe confusing? Okay, so you could do that. The names could be the same, but it's confusing because struct rational and rational don't have to be the same type. And I used a different name on the slide to emphasize that. Yeah. The question is, can you do that in one line? That's the following slide. So yeah, so I'm going to start out building it this way so it's clear what's happening. Yeah. So that the question is, can you have multiple types that are both rational? So it's possible for me to have struct foo and foo be, you know, these could be different. Be different. So this is, they're allowed to be different types by C. If you do that, you probably made a mistake and should stop, but they could be different by the rules of C. So usually they'll be the same type, but you know, you have to actually make that happen. Okay. And you can use this syntax in general. So in addition to defining another name for struct, you can also say type def int my integer or something like that if you want to change between using ints and longs, for example, and define another name for int or long if you change your mind. And you might see that sort of usage. So type def just in general says, give me another name for a type. Yeah. The question is, can I also use the old name? Yes, absolutely. So where I have rational here, I could have written struct other name for rational when I defined 2.5. And that would be completely valid. I don't recommend doing that because it's confusing, but it's completely valid. And as I alluded, there is a way of doing this on one line. And it's a separate slide because it's kind of confusing that this is possible. So it turns out you can do the type def and define the struct in the same line. And that's what this is doing. And I'm showing you this because this is something that you'll see in a lot of C code be done. That they'll define all their structs this way. And you can do one better than this, and that's that you, we have two names here. That's kind of annoying. And maybe I don't really care about typing struct ever. I don't want to ever type struct. Why do I need this other name, even if it happens to have the same characters? And it turns out you can omit that name. You can just say, I'm not going to give a normal name for this struct. I'm just going to give the type def name. And that's valid. And this just defines a type called rational, which is a struct, and doesn't define a name starting with struct for the type. And you'll see this a lot in C code, where people don't like typing struct for some reason. Any questions on this? Yeah. Yeah, so with any of these, I could write rational 2.5. That would be a valid declaration with any of these versions. Okay.
Why would you need the other name for rational then? Or why would you have it?
So the question is, why would I, if I can do this, why do I ever bother typing the other name for rational? And in many code, they don't. They'll always use that last form. There's one case, not for this particular example, where you might need that other name. And that's when you have structs which are self-referential. So a classic example is, let's say you're making a linked list. The linked list needs to have a pointer to another element of the list in it. And that means you need to have a struct type that represents a pointer to itself, that contains that, which means you need to have its name. And you can't use the name list here. You can't type list star next, because if I type, because the type list, so list star would be, is an error. And error because the type list doesn't exist yet until the semicolon. There's no type called list. But you are allowed to use the other name within the struct definition. So if you need to have a pointer to itself, to its own type, this is how you need to use the other name. And that's the most common case where you'll see it. Any questions on this? Yeah.
So is it just best practice to always use type def when declaring a pointer to a struct?
So the question is it best practice to always use type def when declaring a struct? It depends who you're talking to. So there's some large C projects where their style is to never type def structs, to always use the word struct and the name. And there's some where their style is to always do it. So, and you'll see a real variety in practice. So this is how we have a struct that contains a pointer to itself, and you can use it in what's hopefully kind of familiar from 2150, like a linked list. And there's some other functions which come up here which are different from C++. So in C++, you'd use the new operator. That doesn't exist in C. Instead, there's a function in the standard library called malloc, which takes a number of bytes to allocate. And that's how I allocate a node of this list. And similarly, there's delete in C++ that just doesn't exist in C. Instead, we use free to get rid of anything we allocated with malloc. Unlike C++, there's no difference between deleting arrays and deleting single objects in C. All of them use free. So any questions on this dynamic memory allocation? And so using the same thing, you can allocate arrays. So we pass a number of bytes, and arrays are just contiguous memory in C. So instead of saying I want how big an int is, I say I want how big 100 ints is. And we get a pointer to the first element. And if you remember our rules from earlier, we can treat a pointer to the first element almost the same as an array, but the size of the pointer is the size of a memory address. Doesn't know what we allocated. So this is our equivalent of new int and a size and delete of with brackets in C++, which hopefully you've done in 2150. I'm not sure.
So would that free statement know that it needs to delete 100 ints out of array, not just one?
So the question is, does the free statement know how big a thing it needs to get rid of? And the answer is yes. So malloc and free keep track of the sizes no matter what types you use in the middle. Which is not how C++ works. So any questions on this? Yeah.
What would size of array return here?
Okay. So anyone want to answer? You should know enough to answer. People should know. Someone should know enough to answer this.
Four.
Four and eight. So four, I assume the theory is, well, ints are 4 bytes. But so size of the thing array points to is 4. Size of array, even though I called it array, it's a pointer because I declared it as a pointer. So it's 8 because it's a memory address. On our lab machines, yeah. And that's the size I will always use in this class unless I'm explicitly saying otherwise. And note that neither of these know anything about the actual amount of space I allocated, and that's normal. If you want to know how big the array is, you need to keep track. And so, that's a common pattern we'll have. So, everyone here used vector in C++? So, maybe most people. So, if you remember, vector in C++ is the canonical dynamic array type, but it knows how big it is. These plain old pointers don't. So what could you do if you wanted to have something like vector in C? What would be the easiest thing to do from what we've just talked about? Yeah, so a struct that also contains the size. So this is re-implementing vector in C. Little more annoying than what you do in C++, where you just have this built for you and you don't need to type it out, and where you don't need to manually set the size and keep track of it. This is how you do the dynamic arrays you're used to in C. So you pass this struct around, which has both a size and a pointer to the beginning. And this is basically what a vector looks like internally in C++. And you can do all the sorts of operations you want. So let's say I want to make a new range, which is my equivalent of vector, copying an old one. I can just do that with a straightforward for loop. So one question here is, why can't I do this? Here I'm defining vec2, I'm manually copying the size, I'm allocating new memory, I have this big for loop. Why don't I just do the same thing I did in C++ of set vec2 equals vec? And one thing you might say, well, maybe that doesn't compile. It turns out it does compile and run, but it's still wrong. So what's the problem? Yeah. Yeah, so the problem is that this assignment copies each instance variable in the struct. So it takes the pointer to data from vec and makes it be in vec2 as the same pointer. So they both point to the same place. So if you modify one, you modify the other. If you free one, you free the other. And that's not how you expect vectors to work. So you need to actually do this copying, and you need to do it manually. In C++, they figured out how to make it so when you do this straightforward assignment statement, it actually does this copy internally. In C, you're going to have to write that out. Any questions on what's happening here? Okay, so the last little thing is about other types. So in C++ and C, you've probably used ints and longs, maybe shorts. You use chars, which are actually a type of integer. But there's a whole bunch of other built-in integer types, which is that there are signed types and unsigned types. And you've used these in 2150 a little bit. Okay, so these have, you know, two's complement or no sign bit at all values are positive. So different ranges. I'm showing you the ranges on our lab machines. You might find other machines where they have different sizes. And they also have different names. You can just write unsigned or you can write unsigned int. They're the same type. So there's some gotchas with these. And one I'd like to mention in particular, not because we're going to test you on it, but because it's extremely confusing. And that's what happens when you compare signed and unsigned numbers. So if we take an int containing negative 1 and an unsigned int containing 0, and we do the straightforward, which is less, we get that negative 1 is not less than 0. And that's really confusing. And you certainly wouldn't want to have it on like a loop condition. That would be very surprising. And you might say, well, what's happening here? Why would this, isn't my compiler completely broken? And the answer is it's working as intended, unfortunately. And the solution is don't compare signed to unsigned. So that's the short answer. If you need to compare two values, convert to a type which can hold all possible values of both. So in this case, on our lab machines, just cast both sides to long, and then things will work properly. So as for what's actually happening, is that the rule that C has for doing these comparisons is you convert both sides to the same type first. And C happens not to choose the type you want all the time to convert to. In particular, in this case, the decision is to convert to unsigned int. So it converts negative 1 to an unsigned int. It gets this giant number, which is in fact greater than 0, and that's how we get this result. This is broken, but this is how compilers are supposed to work, unfortunately. And the reason why, you'd say, well, you know, GCC, you know, isn't this a bug? Wouldn't they agree it's a bug? Why are they so insistent on that? The reason why is that there are standards. So C compilers, unlike something like Python, there's not like one C compiler. There's a whole bunch of C compilers, and they have to all agree on what to do. And the way this happens is originally there was a book published. And the book said, this is the C language. And a whole bunch of people implemented what that book said to do. Eventually, a little later, the American National Standards Institute wrote a document and said, this is C. And a whole bunch of manufacturers implemented compilers which did exactly what that standard said. And there have been more updates on that standard. And this is what our modern compilers do. They do exactly what the standard says. They might deviate a little bit, but there's usually even compiler options where you say, I really want you to do what this particular version of the standard that someone wrote said. And the standard says, when you're doing comparing signed and unsigned numbers, this is how you do it. Even though it seems to give the wrong answer, but the compilers are faithfully implementing that, even though it's very confusing. So, any questions about these standards? This idea makes sense about how what compilers are doing? Okay. So, since compilers are just doing what the standard says, there's some weird things related to that. And I'll start with this example. So, what do you think should be the output of this program? Like, logically speaking. Should either be 0 or 1, clearly, because that's what we said comparisons return in C. So, what do people, so do people think that this should, oh, and I should mention int max is the largest possible integer. In case that, you know, you don't have to guess, that's what it is. So given that, so who here thinks that this should output 0. But that's the thing that would make the most sense. Who here thinks that this should output 1? That's the thing that would make the most sense. A few people. So what makes the most sense to most people is outputting 0. The logic for that is you add 1 to int max. It wraps around, if you remember how integers work from 2150. And 0 is not going to be greater than anything not going to be, so it wraps around to a negative number, rather, not zero. And that's going to be less than int max. And if you compile this on a recent GCC without optimizations, the output is zero. And since I said without optimizations, you might guess, when you compile it with optimizations, the output is one. And you might reasonably say, well, GCC is clearly wrong somewhere. One of these must be wrong. And that's a reasonable thing to say, right? There should only be one answer. But that's not what happens. The C standard leaves this as undefined behavior. So GCC does two different things for it. And these are both valid. So one thing it does when it optimizes, it just says, oh, that's always true. Of course you add one to something, it's going to be bigger than you started. And it generates assembly code. This is AT&T syntax, but I have comments showing you exactly what it does, which just returns one here. In the other case, or less optimized case, it actually does the addition in the comparison. Yes?
So the optimized one doesn't actually wrap back around?
So the question is, the optimized one doesn't wrap back around. Yes, in the optimized case, GCC doesn't even look at the argument. It just says it's always one. So GCC, the arguments in EDI, that slash RDI, that register is never used in the optimized case. But it turns out, according to those standards that I told you also said you have to compare signed and unsigned numbers wrong, this is actually correct, both of these. And that's because the people writing the standard decided that we're not going to say what happens when signed numbers wrap around, because it works differently on different machines. They just said, we're not going to decide what happens. So the compiler can do whatever they want, and it's fine by us. And GCC takes advantage of this in order to optimize better. It says, portably, you can't know when things wrap around, so I'm just going to assume they don't, because you're not supposed to do that, because that wouldn't be portable. And so its optimizer says, okay, we're going to assume it doesn't wrap around and turn this into just returning one. And that has big advantages for optimizations. It's nice to be able to look at this and not have to consider the corner case of what happens if it was int max, which presumably happens very rarely. And this whole general category of things where the people writing the C standard said, hey, compiler writers, you can do whatever you need to do. We don't care what you do, is called undefined behavior. And they can really do whatever they want. So it would also have been valid for GCC to generate code which crashes when you pass in max. That is something that's allowed. Because the people who wrote the specification about what C is didn't decide what wrapping around does, whether it wraps around or something else. And lots of things you might try to do in C are undefined behavior. So I mentioned signed integer overflow, but there's some other very common categories. And one of them is a question which we looked at earlier, I think, which is out-of-bounds pointers. Let's say I have an array. Let's say I try to access outside the array. What happens? So as far as the C standard is concerned, it's undefined behavior. In practice, what's going to happen? The compiler is going to generate the most convenient code, and it's probably going to access random memory. And that's why they didn't define what happens. But this is not like Java, where when you access out-of-bounds of the array, you get an exception. That's not what happens here. Here, the compiler, it could crash your program with a seg fault to say you made a mistake, or it could not. It could just access some other part of memory, and who knows what happens. And there's a whole bunch of other things you might do in C that cause this. That's what I have for today. So good luck on the lab. and next time we'll talk a bit about assembly.